please the court. The district court awarded the plaintiff nearly $1 million in fees for unsuccessfully opposing the city's motion to modify the consent decree, for unsuccessfully pursuing...
What is the aggregate amount of fees so far in the history of this litigation that the city has paid?
Your Honor, unfortunately, I'm not able to find all of that information in our records. There's no dispute that the...
There's no record of the fees you've paid over the last 22 years?
Well, unfortunately, I wasn't able to pull that together in any helpful way. There doesn't appear to be any dispute, however, that the plaintiffs have already been compensated.
No, I know. I'm just curious what the aggregate
is. Yes, Your Honor. I will make an effort to find it again. I was curious myself. The fees awarded here were for unsuccessfully opposing modification, unsuccessfully pursuing 3 contempt petitions, and for monitoring that was duplicative of the responsibilities of the police board under the decree. There are 2 central flaws in the district court's decision. First, plaintiffs are not entitled to compensation for unsuccessful work that's not appropriately related to the claims on which they prevailed. And second, plaintiffs are not entitled to compensation for work that brings them no meaningful benefit. None of the plaintiffs' post-judgment work was appropriately related to the claims they prevailed on. This court's prior opinion ordering modification supports just this point. There, the court made quite clear that by the late 1990s, by the time the motion to modify litigation and all of the contempt petitions were pending, the pattern of misconduct that had produced the decree, the Red Squad, was history. Thus, the claims on which the plaintiffs prevailed were also history as well. The post-judgment work raised fresh questions, fresh litigation, including whether the decree had been overtaken by time, whether the decree had been violated,
If it's been overtaken, why hasn't the city moved to dissolve it?
Under the modified decree, which is to be in, after 5 years of the modified decree being in place, the city is authorized to revisit the issue of vacating this, even the modified decree in its entirety.
Wait, do you have to run that? Where is this authorization?
I believe it's in the proposed modified decree. Toward the end, it does state that after
this court will consider whether further modification or dissolution
correct.
Is warranted.
Correct.
So now this was your proposal, is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. So 5 years from when? From 2001?
Right. The post-judgment litigation raised these new and fresh questions, in the contempt petitions as well, of questions whether there is clear and convincing evidence of decree violation. None of these questions have anything to do with the claims on which the plaintiff prevailed in 1982, and none of these questions required revisitation of any of the merits of the underlying case. And Hensley instructs that under Section 1988, even prevailing plaintiffs are not entitled to compensation for work that was not part of the process of obtaining relief in their favor. Nor did plaintiffs obtain any meaningful benefit from any or meaningful relief from any of the post-judgment works that they performed. And under Farrar, meaningless relief deserves no fee at all. From opposing 4 years of vigorous...
Well, when you say they obtained no meaningful relief, did they obtain any relief?
They have attempted to characterize some of what they obtained as relief, and as the most charitable view we can allocate that is that it was not meaningful relief.
Well, what was it?
It's really no nominal relief at best.
What
was it specifically?
Like what?
The plaintiffs have pointed to 4 years of extending the life of the decree as a benefit. But of course, this court has already held in its prior opinion ordering modification that the modified decree was fully protective of the plaintiff's rights. So extending the decree for 4 years.
That's their only relief?
That's the only relief they've ever
pointed
to. And as far as the contempt petitions, the most they've ever pointed to, again, no practical benefit whatsoever, merely a few so-called, and in our view, not clearly favorable judicial statements. About the law that...
Oh, statements. statements and opinions.
Correct, which were divorced from any concrete relief. And under Farrar, the only reasonable fee for this type of so-called relief is no fee at all. If there are no further questions, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Tracy. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
It's Zirechny.
Pardon?
Zirechny?
Zirechny?
Yes.
Zirechny?
Yes.
Okay, I was mispronouncing.
Well, that's okay.
Thank you for the correction. Mr. Schwartz?
May it please the Court. Quick answer to one of the questions you raised. This is the first fee petition of the Roger Ballin Foundation of the ACLU. I'm not sure at this moment how much money has been paid in fees in this case so far.
Do you have any ballpark estimates?
I do not. The useful and necessary test of...
Let me just clarify. So you're representing the Alliance?
No, Your Honor. I represent the ACLU plaintiffs. We're splitting our time.
The ACLU. So you've abandoned your cross appeal. Do they have a cross appeal?
Yes and yes. We are not, the ACLU is not
so
part of
the... So you split with them on the cross appeal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes. So the ACLU is one of these, is one of the plaintiffs, is that it? Plaintiffs are a bunch of organizations.
Your Honor, there are two separate plaintiff classes that were certified early in this litigation. One is the ACLU plaintiff class, the other is the Alliance plaintiff class.
But each class, it consists of organizations, or are there individuals also?
Organizations and individuals. And of course,
the members of the organization?
Excuse me?
And the members of organizations?
And the members, and of course.
Do they exist? Do all these organizations still exist?
I do not know the answer to that. I do know that each represents a class that includes millions of residents of the city of Chicago. The primary point that the plaintiffs would like to, the ACLU plaintiffs would make in argument here, is that the useful and necessary test should be interpreted.
Yeah, but my problem is, let me ask you this. Why isn't a sensible way to look at a case like this by analogy to bankruptcy? So in bankruptcy, you have a petition filed, and it goes on maybe for years, usually ending in discharge of the debtor. And in the course of that, there may be all sorts of proceedings, the clearest case, you know, adversary proceedings. So they're little lawsuits. They're treated as, you know, independent proceedings within the overall bankruptcy. They're appealable and so on and so forth. And they're analyzed separately. So why not treat a consent decree the same way? That if you have the consent decree's been going on for 22 years, but in the course of it, you know, there are these standalone proceedings, the contempt, the modification, flap, and then we could look at each of these and see, you know, who won and who lost. Why wouldn't that make sense?
Your Honor, the plaintiffs believe that does not make sense because this framework is governed by the useful and necessary test set forth by the Supreme Court in Delaware Valley.
No, Delaware Valley doesn't help you because Delaware Valley is a case where the plaintiffs obtained relief. You know, it's the up and down case. They didn't get everything they wanted, but their post-judgment, so that's a post-judgment case like the modification is contempt. So there were these post-judgment proceedings in Delaware Valley, and the plaintiffs won. They won everything, but they got some relief, so they were prevailing parties in this post-judgment proceeding. Well, similarly, you have these post-judgment proceedings. Put aside the monitoring, that's somewhat different, but the contempts and the modification, little post-judgment proceedings, they can be analyzed separately, and you lost them. So why isn't that the end of the analysis?
Your Honor, we don't think these should be analyzed separately in the manner that you're saying.
Why? Because they would be in bankruptcy. Why not? What's the difference?
I can't speak to the bankruptcy analogy. It's beyond my knowledge. What I can say is that the entry of the consent decree radically transforms the nature of these proceedings. At that point, the district court has a duty to see that
that's mysticism. What the consent decree does, just like bankruptcy, reorganization, so on, it subjects the city to a series of summary proceedings, right? And instead of having to bring a new First Amendment suit, which of course if you'd done and lost, you wouldn't have any fee claim. Instead of that, you know, you bring these summary proceedings called contempt instead of, you know, a suit for under 1983. So, but analytically, there's no different, nothing related to the policy of the fee-shifting statutes that I can see.
We disagree, Your Honor. The relief provided by the decree is fundamentally intertwined with the claims underlying this lawsuit. The modification proceedings, which account for
more. Let me ask Judge Posner's question in a somewhat different way. By reference to a different consent decree that's bound the city for a long time. That's the Shackman decree that limited political hiring. And there are a series, or have been historically, a series of specific efforts under Shackman to implement Shackman by saying a given discharge violated the Shackman decree. Now, your theory seems to imply that even if a particular employee brings a particular proceeding under Shackman saying, I was discharged wrongfully, and he loses outright, he still recovers, his attorney's fees are still covered, because after all, he was one of the prevailing parties in the Shackman decree, although he couldn't show that it was violated in this case. Does that make any sense?
Your Honor, I think that under the facts that you just described, it is impossible to know whether or not fees should be appropriately awarded. There are a number of factors that we appropriately
considered. Plaintiff's lawyer says this person was a member of the Shackman class. He was therefore a prevailing party in the Shackman case. He's filed a lawsuit to vindicate the Shackman decree, and although he didn't show on the facts that he was entitled to any relief, he's still a prevailing party.
I think among the facts...
UED.
You would need to know whether the work was reasonable. In this case, our work was reasonable. You would need to know...
Look, I'm going to hypothesize that the work was reasonable in relation to the claim that the person was making. That is, he's making a claim that he was a victim of political discharge. Perfectly normal attorney's fees are expended in order to pursue a claim of political discharge. And he loses on the facts after the judge concludes that the discharge was not political.
Your hypothetical involves a motion to prosecute or to enforce. The majority of the HLE work on this appeal is a motion for modification.
I'm not asking you about this appeal. I'm asking you how your theory applies to the Shackman case.
What I'm trying to say is that in some cases, in your analogy, fees might be appropriate. In other cases, they would not be appropriate. These considerations of whether or not the work is related, whether or not the work is useful, whether or not the work is necessary, are properly entrusted within the
work. I'm asking you to assume that the work, in my hypothetical, hardly hypothetical, we've seen lots of those proceedings, was perfectly normal, ordinary, and reasonable work for the kind of claim involved, but that it failed on the facts.
I think that there would be an entitlement to fees in that kind of case, and it would be within the district court's discretion to impose downward multipliers, as the court did in this case, imposing, for example, a 90% downward multiplier on work in the enforcement petition and a 25% downward multiplier for work on the opposition to modification. The essential point is that we had a... Thank you, Your Honor.
I wasn't talking to you. Oh. I was talking to him. Someone popped up. You can finish your thought.
This was a far-reaching public policy question, whether or not to modify the decree in the manner proposed by the city. It was simply beyond the competence of the plaintiffs to resolve this without subjecting it to the crucible of discovery, briefing, and adjudication by this court. It's a question upon which reasonable jurists could and, in fact, did disagree. And in this setting, it is useful and necessary to the district court to obtain the assistance of counsel through and the parties in these types of proceedings. And accordingly, fees should be awarded.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Schwartz. Mr. Gutman?
I apologize for standing up.
That's okay.
May it please the court, I'm Richard Gutman. I'm the plaintiff for Alliance Plaintiffs. I'd like to start with responding directly to Judge Posner and Judge Easterbrook's questions about why should this event happening after the consent decree, why should they not be treated separately? And the reason, I think, is, as explained in Delaware Valley Supreme Court case, that winning a consent decree is only part of the battle.
So how would you treat the Shackman case?
I would treat it that reasonable work to ensure compliance is as much a part of the lawsuit as the work before the consent decree was won.
So on your view, if somebody who says, I'm a victim of political firing, brings a suit denominated as one under 1983 and loses, he gets no attorney's fees.
Correct.
But if his attorney has the wit to say, I'm also bringing this in order to enforce the Shachtman decree, he gets attorney's fees as a prevailing party, even though he loses.
Correct. If it really is enforcing the consent decree, the Shachtman consent decree needs to be monitored. It has to be enforced, or it's meaningless.
Have any of the many district courts hearing what seem to be the hundreds of proceedings under the Shachtman decree ever awarded fees on that rationale?
Your Honor, I'm not involved in the Shachtman case.
Unsuccessful party. These cases leave their trail in the books.
Your Honor, I'm not a lawyer in the Shachtman case. I have no knowledge of the case.
Let me ask you another question. Suppose the city had moved successfully, not for modification, but for dissolution of the decree. Suppose we had dissolved it. Would you still be able to obtain fees for having tried to prevent that result?
Yes, isn't that the Bollock case? Might be mispronounced.
No, that can't be right.
In the Bollock case,
that would be a case where your efforts had been totally futile.
But opposing the motion is part
look,
of the representation.
But look, in all these cases, suppose in an ordinary 1983 case, you win in the district court, you win a huge judgment, and when the other side appeals, you are obligated to defend your judgment. But if you lose in the court of appeals and get nothing, you get no fees. So what's the difference if, you know, they move to dissolve the decree, you prevail in district court, it's appealed, we reverse, we say this decree is dead, and yet you claim you can get fees in that case?
But in...
What sense does that make?
In the previous decision of some court, Usrock...
Usrock was a case where we said, yes, of course the... plaintiff was obligated to defend his judgment, and he won. He didn't win everything he wanted, and we cut down his fees a lot, but he won something. You haven't won anything.
Well, in People Who Care, there was an appeal. They lost the appeal, was dismissed, and the Seventh Circuit reinstituted the full fee award because that was part of the post-decree work. This post-decree work is necessary. If an attorney...
But it's the same thing. If you win a case in a district court, it is necessary that you... I mean, suppose you win a district in the district court, and you really have a very good chance of winning in the Court of Appeals also. So, of course, you defend your judgment. But if you lose as a result of the Court of Appeals, you know, unpredictable caprice, then you get nothing in the way of damages. And why is this any different? Especially since you've been on this gravy train for 22 years now.
Well, Your Honor...
We may not know what the total amount of fees, but this is costing the city, you know, $100,000 a year or something. And why is it that they have to pay for every one of your losses? Every time they win, they pay your attorney's fees.
The reason is because it's necessary to ensure protection of the consent decree. It's part of the job.
I don't understand that. I don't understand why it's ever necessary to take incorrect legal positions. When you lose one of these ancillary proceedings, the district court has determined that the position was incorrect, and it's not necessary to be incorrect.
Because under the rules of professional conduct, I have a responsibility to make a reasonable argument in defense
of
my client.
Then you have to come back and say you should be entitled to attorney's fees in all of these cases, whether you win or lose, because under the rules of professional conduct, you should be an advocate even for losing positions.
Well, the statute...
That's not the law.
No, the statute says that you must be a prevailing party. We are a prevailing party because we won a consent decree.
No, but maybe the right way to look at this is you were a prevailing party in 1982, and you haven't been ever since. Ever since then, you've been taking one series of losing positions after another.
Your Honor, with all due respect, I would suggest that's inconsistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Delaware Valley. which emphasized that post-decree work...
Delaware Valley has nothing to do with it, because this post-decree work in Delaware Valley was successful.
Some of it was and some of it wasn't. There was a...
But you have zero success. Once you have partial success, then you can argue about, well, the partial, you should be paid for all your efforts, because to get the partial success, you have to drill some dry holes. That's fine. But if you have zero success, then you're a loser. And it's safe. There's an awkwardness in this decree. You've got this perpetual decree. The world is changing around us. The decree goes on forever. You want to go on forever. Which means that over a period of 20-odd, 30, 50 years, you might be wholly futile in your efforts to enforce the decree, and yet the city would have to pay your fees year after year.
Well, I don't think this decree is going to last forever, but we have a responsibility to represent our clients, and that's part of our...
You don't have a responsibility to keep losing.
If we have a good faith, non-frivolous argument, if our client has an argument to be made that's not frivolous, that's reasonable, that's related, we have an obligation to make it, and that's part of our job. And if I knew that when I took this case, that even if we won, and even if our overall level of success was excellent, and the city has never disputed that, and the judge has never found otherwise, if I knew that I was not going to get compensated for parts of the case during the 20 years of the case, where if it wasn't successful, then I may not have taken the case, and other lawyers will feel the same.
No, that's not true, because you could have walked away from the decree after it was entered. There's nothing in the decree that subjects you to duties with regard to enforcement. There's this monitoring by the police board and so on, but you're not required to do monitoring.
But we didn't initiate. The city made
suits or anything like that.
The city made the motion to modify, and we responded.
Let's talk about the monitoring and the contempts. You had no professional obligation to handle either of those matters.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. We have a duty to monitor. And
Where is that in the decree?
Well, it says that the plaintiffs have the right to make motions to enforce.
Rights and duties to do. There's nothing. I don't think there's anything in the decree that imposes any duties on you.
It implies that we have the responsibility.
I don't see the implication of responsibility, since they set up other mechanisms. Police board, there's this audit business. That's where the duty is imposed, not imposed on the lawyers for the class.
Well, the police board is limited to the information the police department gives it. We're responsible for talking to people who have first-hand information and determining whether a violation has occurred.
That's not in the decree.
I think it's in, as Delaware Valley stated, that a lawyer and as Jaffe, or people who care, stated, the plaintiffs have a responsibility to ensure that the consent decree is not an empty word on a piece of paper. That's part of our responsibility. Otherwise, it's meaningless if no one is enforcing it. I felt a responsibility, I'm sure the other plaintiff's lawyers did, to not walk away when there's a consent decree, and that enforcing of it is as much as important as part as the initial work getting it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gutman, Mr. Schwartz. Ms. Drechny, how much time does she have? 10 minutes? 9 minutes? No, I don't think you'll need 9 minutes.
No, Your Honor. at this time, we would simply ask that the judgment be reversed, unless the court has any further questions.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to both sides. Next case.